This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. There's Ron with two N's, hour three. Ryan Ballinger will talk Ryder Cup at the bottom of the hour. We will get to the baseball stuff because playoffs are starting on Tuesday now that the regular season is done. NFL Week 4 continues tonight with the Seattle Seahawks 2-1 taking on the Giants, who are 1-2. So that will wrap up Week 4. Don't forget, tomorrow we'll have top 5 and bottom 5. We might shake some things up a little bit. So we were going through some of the games. The Cowboys bounced back against the Patriots. They won 38-3. The 35 points that is the margin of victory for the Cowboys, that is the worst loss in Bill Belichick's coaching career. Okay, so I'm going to say this, and this is no disrespect to Belichick. He's great, and he's coached nearly 500 games. But it's not easy to lose by 35 points in the NFL, right? I mean, it's kind of hard to do that even if you stink, to lose by 35 points. And Belichick, again, he had the best team in the league for 20 years with the best quarterback in the league for 20 years. So the sample size, can we take the 20 years out off the board and just go, in reality, this is his worst loss in the years he was in Cleveland and the years post-Brady? That's more impressive, I guess, or more accurate than the 20 years that he had as one of the best teams in the NFL. And again, I think the people that are trying to take that away from him, look, it goes hand in hand, right? I think that people who want to now look at the Patriots and say, clearly now the success of the 20 years belongs to Tom Brady. That's inaccurate. Belichick is the coach of one of the greatest teams in sports history. Teams don't dominate for 20 years these days. It's going to go down in basketball, in baseball, in hockey, NFL, whatever. Teams don't dominate for 20 years like that. He's part of it. He gets credit for it. You may not like it. You can give him less credit, but it's not going to be entirely on Tom Brady. I will say, and we talked about this earlier, I do think that it is time for the Patriots to seriously evaluate Belichick's role with the team going forward. Not immediately. I don't think he should be fired for 1-3. But if I'm Robert Kraft, I do not want to hang on to loyalty so much that I'm watching the team and a roster he built suffer losses like that. Non-competitive games, right? I don't think again, it's the long play. It's not the emotional play. It's not the radical play. It's a long play. I think there is going to be a point soon, if this keeps up, that they're going to have to part ways with Belichick. Belichick does not have a job for life. No NFL coach has a job for life. You are going to be evaluated because the team wants to be in the conversation all the time. If you're an owner, all the time. You can take a rebuilding time, but you better be back. You better make that quick and get moving. But to lose by 35, and now there's a quarterback issue. Now there's going to be all week. This is something Belichick loved not having. That was the one thing with Brady that he never had to deal with. And I honestly think it's the reason he brought Cam Newton in the year after Brady left in 2020. I think Belichick doesn't want this. He doesn't want the media talking about it. He doesn't want the fan base divided on it. He doesn't want to be asked questions a million times on it, which is probably the primary reason he doesn't want it. I think, though, he had to do it yesterday. That team needed a spark. Bailey Zappi could have been that spark. It could have been send a message to Mac Jones. I don't care what it is, but now he's got one on his hands. And maybe there's a deflection there where now the media is going to be on the quarterback rather than the coach, but the two go hand in hand. Right? And I think there that, again, when you've spent 20 years being surly with the media at times, dismissive of the media at times, treating them like morons, treating them like idiots, like they don't know anything, when they were asking very good questions, and then you answering questions with on to Cincinnati, when your team stunk with Brady, and you would just go on to Cincinnati. And while that was prophetic, because you would go to on to Kansas City, on to Cincinnati, whoever you were playing, and win that game, it never answered the deficiencies of what caused you to say that in the first place. So it was always just sort of this, trust me, I know what I'm doing, people. And the media is like, we never said you didn't, but we do need to ask you some questions. How you respond to those questions, it's up to you. But we're going to ask them anyway. I honestly think that the real rule is in journalism that you are just looking for an answer. The answer could be anything. But any coach that makes you feel like you don't have the right to ask a certain question is kind of destroying the process. I can ask anything I want. If you give me no answer, that's your answer. If you give me a one-word answer, that's the answer. If you elaborate on that and let me know what's going on inside the locker room and in the front office and give me way more than I want, that's your answer. But I should be able to ask whatever I want, and you just answer it the way you want without being offended by the question. And that's kind of what Belichick would do. The team would lose a game. There would be some serious issues. People would want to know about those serious issues for their readers or their listeners or their viewers or whatever it is. And Belichick would say, scoff at it and just say, we're pointing to the next game. And some of the fans got a little arrogant because some of the fans on their little social media would see a blowout and say, on to Cincinnati. And then what happened when, after the Brady era, when it was on to this and on to that and on to this, and the losses kept coming up? Well, now those fan bases are saying, that fan base is now saying, well, okay, all right, this is now what is going on here. We're now 1-3. And you could make the argument last night's game that they're worse than the Jets, even though the Jets beat them in week 3. Now, that's a little bit of a bold statement, I'll be honest with you, because one game of Zach Wilson playing well on a Sunday night does not make up for some of the moments where he was not a very good quarterback. But if he has indeed turned that corner, that's what's going to get the Jets in the conversation. That defense is stellar. There is some offensive weapons there. The offensive line isn't very good. But if Wilson can manage through that, they're going to be a team that's going to win some games here. And we'll see when it's all said and done where they're at. But the Patriots, I don't see anything there. And this is a better offensive team. But I don't see anything there because they haven't got the quarterback right. And that's a problem. And Dallas, we said this last week when Dallas lost to Arizona. Every now and then the Cowboys do this, where they kind of vomit on themselves.
Yeah.
And they lose a game where you're like, wow, we really believed in Dallas. And then they puked on themselves, and now we don't even know what to think about them anymore. This was a great game to bounce back from what they did in Arizona. And they all kind of said it afterwards. You know, hey, look, we needed to refocus. We refocus to get the job done. And they did. They did. The defense was opportunistic. They don't have Trayvon Diggs. Didn't matter. Two turnovers directly resulted in Cowboy touchdowns, and they put this team away with ease. So, but if I'm a New England fan, I'm not turning on Bill. He gave me so much. He gave me more than any NFL team should ever deserve. Right? You've heard me say this a million times. Guys, in our lifetime, if we can get 2 or 3 Super Bowl championships in our entire lifetime, that's all we really can ask.
Yep.
Some of us have had 0.
Yep, I know. I know.
Oh, yeah, it's true. You know, I was thinking like Lions fan, but you're right. Yeah.
Well, Lions fan hasn't been there. At least we were there once.
Yeah, you were there once. So for this guy to have given New England fans, you know, 9 trips to the game.
Yeah.
6 championships in the game. Like that is a lot, but unfortunately it is a, what have you done for me lately type of league. That's the way it is. And that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
Right. That's the way it should be. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it should be. And that leads me to one of the baseball stories, which is Buck Showalter got fired yesterday.
Did he get fired or did he quit?
Either way, he's not coming back.
He's not coming back.
Either way, he's not coming back. I think he got fired because he had a year left on his contract. Too. He got a year left on his contract.
But I mean, the first report came back out was like, you know, he decided he was going to show up, but it was like, this seemed weird.
Well, a lot of times they do that knowing what is coming.
Yeah,
like they're beating you to the punch. There's going to be a new front office guy, I guess, for the Mets,
You know what? And here's the deal too, right? Because you and I love the Mets for other reasons, not right. because of the baseball team. They really messed themselves the last 2 weeks of the season, last week of the season.
Right.
I really felt like it. I mean, the whole thing with the Marlins is cracks me up.
Oh, yeah. All the rain and moving things, and the field was too wet.
The field was too wet because the grounds crew were like, I don't want to go out there.
So Buck Showalter, he got hired in December of 21. Okay. Last year, he won 101 games. They lost in the wild card round to San Diego. They had the biggest payroll in baseball. An owner that loved being the Mets owner, not a baseball owner, the Mets owner. They finished 30 and a half games behind Atlanta in the division. And I think that was it. So David Stearns is going to be the baseball president of operations. They're announcing him today. And he is above Billy Epler, who's the general manager. So they've got a new sheriff in town to run this. And this, I guarantee you that in the process of hiring Stearns, Steve Cohen and the group said, you can change managers. Like, I'm sure Stearns said that. He said, look, if I'm going to come here and I'm going to run this team, I need to have my guy needs to be skipper. That's it. That's a deal breaker. I have to bring in my guy I have to choose the next manager. And they said, you know what? We love Buck, but we're going to do that. We're going to give that to you. You know, because remember the movie Moneyball where Art Howe, Philip Seymour Hoffman, is like,
yes.
I can't do this on a one-year contract?
Mm-hmm.
Well, David Stearns was going to have to go to Buck Showalter and go, you got two choices. We're either going to fire you now and pay you out on this contract, or you're going to manage under a one-year contract, but you're not going to be the manager here. So what do you want to do? Do you want to manage with no security net, or do you want to just take the payout and go find another job? And I'm sure Buck went, you know what, I think I'm going to get out of here. Mets went from 101 wins last season to, again, 30 and a half in 1 year. There you go. We'll continue. Ryan Ballinger will join us at the bottom of the hour. All right, let's get a little bit to Colorado USC. When we come back, it's Wake Up Call.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, Ryan Ballinger from Golf News Net will join us. We'll talk to him about the Ryder Cup. Still talking about week four of the NFL. Again, Giants Seahawks tonight. College football. Look, there were some really good games this past Saturday. Really good games. I thought the LSU-Ole Miss game was an epic, epic battle. That was really fun to watch. That is called the Magnolia Bowl. Because everything, like, in the SEC, like, they've been playing since, like, the beginning of time, like, these teams. But that was a great game. Auburn almost pulled off the upset of number one Georgia. But the game everybody was kind of buzzing about was USC-Colorado. And Colorado's still getting a lot of the attention, obviously, because of Deion Sanders and the celebrities that he is bringing to Boulder. And he brought a ton. There were a ton of celebrities for that game.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, it really is ridiculous. But again, it was USC, too, so there was power of the USC brand that was going to Boulder. And I think if you are somebody that had the means of being part of this sort of celebrity entourage, that's the game you're going to go to. It's Southern Cal. They're one of the top teams in the country. Caleb Williams. And again, and then there's Deion Sanders. Like, why wouldn't you go to Boulder? It's beautiful. I was really impressed with Colorado and Shador Sanders. I was really impressed. That game could have easily gotten away from Colorado. They have zero. They have no defense. They have no defense. But sometimes they did. Sometimes they played well enough that they did. You know, they got a sack or they got a one turnover. They got an interception. They did go out there and play with a little more heart. And remember, they were down Shiloh Sanders and of course Travis Hunter, who's the best two-way player in college football. They were out, both of those guys, and they almost pulled this off. Sanders was magnificent. I really thought he's really, there was a feeling of this guy's an NFL prospect, a first-round NFL prospect. I think it solidified it. He really, now granted, he does things the scouts are all saying, look, he holds the ball a little too long, he takes a few sacks. Even Joe Klatt pointed out in the game that when he was scrambling, couldn't find anything, he threw it out of bounds. And they're like, that is something that Shador Sanders has not done all year. And that is something he's adding to his game. But Caleb Williams threw six touchdowns, over 400 yards in this game. Colorado did come back in the second half. And sometimes, and this is not to say that their effort wasn't valiant. Please do not misinterpret. When you're up 41-14, you are going to be like, all right, what are we going to, you're going to slow down a little bit. And then fortunately, mm-hmm. they slowed down just enough that Colorado got back into
the game. Your foot off the gas.
You take your foot off the gas. You took your foot off the gas. And that is not to disparage the run that the Buffaloes made. They made a great run. They really did. Those, I mean, the touchdowns, Sanders, especially the one he hit at the end of the third quarter when he hit Harrison, was a beautiful throw. I mean, it was right in a perfect window. Omarion Miller, and I want to make that clear because it was people were calling him something else, but Shador Sanders had the right pronunciation of his last name. He had a fantastic game for a team that did not have Travis Hunter on it. I do want to thank some people that did reach out to me saying that it was the broadcast again was dripping with a little too much prime love. Listen.
Did he change his name, by the way?
To,
has it been legally changed to Coach Prime?
Yeah, right. See, when I pointed out, people are starting
Deion
to
Prime?
Notice it. When I pointed out.
No, it was that glass-shattering thing.
That's right. Once you hear it all the time. Maybe before, you didn't quite hear it a lot. Now, when you start hearing it, you realize, yeah, he's everyone is now saying Coach Prime in everything that they do. They have totally forgotten that his real name is Coach Sanders. And that's the way he should have been addressed, but whatever. I have to say this. I don't know if you're Fox. Do you want to change Gus Johnson at all? Probably not. But I would even admit, I think even the Fox people would have to go, yeah, he's clearly pulling for Deion Sanders. His tone and excitement, which is always at 11, to use the Spinal Tap reference, was even more 11 when Colorado did anything. You know? When Colorado did anything. Now, I will say, that I'm going to give Gus Johnson a pass for this. When you are doing a 41-14 game, you feel like you are wasting everyone's time, right? Like, ugh, we got a long way to go, and this thing is turning into a rout, and how do I keep the energy of this game going? I just did a high school football game on Friday night. The final score was 41-0. And by the way, did you know why it was a fun night for me for a 41-0 game in which the team I cover lost? Because Tennessee state rule says if a team is up by 30 points or more, running clock. It's great. Running clocks are awesome. They don't stop it for unless injury or timeouts. They just let it roll. Everybody gets to get out of there early. That was great. But when you're up, when you're not in a running clock situation and you know you still have a good hour and a half left of a broadcast and it's 41-14, any movement made by the team that's losing to sort of make the game a little tighter, you're probably going to up your game a little bit. You're probably going to up your vocals a little bit. So when Anthony Henderson scored and made it 41-21, it's still a 20-point game. Gus Johnson is probably going to ratchet it up to get you guys interested that this game might be interesting. But then it's 48-21. You're probably going back to, oh, goodness. So I got to give him a little pass on that. Look, Colorado's got a long way to go. From a standpoint of being a national championship competing team, okay? Their trenches are bad. Their quarterback is great. When Travis Hunter plays and he's healthy, he's fantastic. Jimmy Horn is a great player. Omarion Miller is good. Jimmy Ward is good. Some of the guys they have are pretty decent. Their trenches are not good. They're not good. The offensive line is not good, and the defensive line is not good. They need to get better. Now, there's this sort of belief by many that Deion is just going to do that, and that's fine. But as I said, it's going to be more difficult for him to recruit linemen than it is any other skill position. Deion is a skilled guy, right? He's one of the best two-way players in sports from a baseball, football aspect, right? He was one of the greatest cover corners in the history of the game. He's defined the position. He's like the Lawrence Taylor of that position. He changed the way guys prepare for that job. He was that instrumental and influential on the corner position in the National Football League. He knows wide receivers, and he knows corners, and he knows all the guys that get you points. Can he recruit linemen the same way he's recruiting the big stars with the big NIL, with all the celebrities and all of that? Can he convince a defense? Like, think about, let's think about this for a second. And hear me out. If you're a lineman, what do you want to do? You're big. You're 300-plus pounds, muscle. What do you want to do? Do you want to go party at a school where everybody's got, where all the celebrities are hanging out? Or do you want to go play for a guy that helps you get to the NFL? Can Deion help a kid, an offensive guard, get to the NFL? He can help a skill player get to the NFL. Can he help an offensive line get to the NFL? There are places that those linemen can go to where they know they're going to get the tools they need to be a good NFL offensive lineman or defensive lineman. Now, I don't know the answer to that. And to be honest with you, I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. Right? And that's going to be the key if Colorado wants to take those next couple of steps when they move to the Big 12 next year. But I think that this Buffalo's team, when they get to the Big 12 minus Texas and Oklahoma, they're going to be one of the best teams in that conference. And if you're one of the best teams in that conference, guess what? You get to go to the playoff. And when you get to the playoff, who knows? So, is it bright for Colorado? Everyone's been saying that. I do worry as years progress, it's about your quarterback. I mean, think about the quarterbacks, right? Alabama quarterbacks have come and gone, right? None of them go to the NFL and do much, but it doesn't matter. They're good game managers. They're good under pressure. Alabama's championships have come by having good skill players on offense, a smart quarterback, and a defense you can't score against, right? So whether it's Greg McElroy, whether it is A.J. McCarron, whether it's – I mean, outside of Tua and Jalen Hurts, those earlier quarterbacks have not gone to the NFL and won.
Mac Jones? No.
Mac Jones, no.
We've already talked about
right?
it.
But Tua, yes. Tua, yes. Jalen Hurts, yes.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so those guys are great. But for the most part, Alabama quarterbacks are not ones that go on and do great things in the National Football League. But yet the machine kept going. Same thing with Georgia. Like, Stetson Bennett, yeah, we'll see. But they win by having great offensive lines and defensive lines, and you can't score on them. Georgia's defense is guys constant NFL ready. Now, if Deion is going to recruit, and he does well in those areas, he's going to be fantastic. But what do we know about the quarterbacks in college? Well, they're hard to replace, right? You get a quarterback like Tim Tebow at Florida. He was not the starter when they won against Ohio State, but he was when they beat Oklahoma. But what happened after that? Florida has never been anywhere near the national championship game since.
I guess what you need to do is you need to do what Oklahoma was doing and just take other people's quarterbacks.
That's right. Keep bringing in different quarterbacks. But what if he can't replace Shador Sanders in a couple of years?
And I guarantee you're not.
Right. What if Shador Sanders is that kind of player that is so good, he's hard to replace? Now, granted, again, recruits are recruits. You never know. But I think people, let's give this a little bit before we start heaping national championship aspirations on Colorado. But I say this very impressed with Shador Sanders. And I'm thinking to myself, as I saw him in the black Colorado jersey, that a black Steeler jersey would look really good on that kid.
This is Brett Musburger, and you are listening live to Wake Up Call on SportsMap Radio with my main man, Tony D.
All right, welcome back as we continue along on Wake Up Call. Ryan Ballingy joining us fresh from his return from Rome, Italy, where the United States loses the Ryder Cup on European soil yet again. 1993, the last time they did it. He's from Golf News Net, joins us to talk about the Ryder Cup. How are you, my friend?
Good, Tony. How are you?
By the way, thank you for joining us. I know it's a long flight and a big, tough week, and I really appreciate it because I would still be in Rome if I was over there. I'd just be like, I think I'm going to stay 3 or 4 more days. How was the trip, by the way? How was Rome, the city, welcoming in the Ryder Cup?
They did a fantastic job. It was really pretty easy getting to and from the tournament other than throngs of people, right? A good metro system, good bus system to and from the metro to the tournament. They did a really good job with it, I thought. And I think a lot of people expected Italy to do, frankly, a poor job, and it was anything but. And Rome's an incredible city. I mean, my wife and I were in the city for 5 days, and I cannot recommend going there enough. It was incredible.
All right, let's get to the result. This seems like another just trend in this event, the United States losing in Europe. When Europe comes to the United States, the last couple of trips, they have gotten beaten. Is this now turning into the home advantage is so great, it's really, really hard to break it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think the last 5, 6 Ryder Cups have pretty much proved that point. I mean, even with Medina, where the Europeans came back from 10-6 on the final day, even that looked like it was going to be a blowout. And 14 wasn't close, 16 wasn't close, 18 wasn't close, 21 wasn't close, and this one wasn't close. And it has turned into a point where the home advantage is almost unfair. And it's not I don't think it's a setup thing, but the host side gets to set up the course. I don't think it's that. I think it's just the nature of how teams come together on their home soil, and it's worth a good 3 points in Ryder Cup play. And 3 points out of a 28-point format, well, that's three you take away from the other side, so really it's worth six. And then you got to be the better team. And it's just really, really difficult to do. And so that's why we've seen this kind of back and forth of just absolute poundings that happen on both sides. And I don't see anything that's going to change that anytime soon.
Obviously, the hindsight is always valuable because we always get to go back and play Monday morning quarterback. But did Zach Johnson make mistakes here? Did he make mistakes with the layoff? Did he make mistakes in pairing? Everyone was talking about Justin Thomas and his heart, but it didn't result in anything. Did he make mistakes here?
I think that he did, but also the six guys that qualified automatically played very poorly.
Yeah.
They didn't play. So that was the hand he was dealt regardless. And I think the intuition of a captain is you want to play the guys that qualify through the process. They're probably the best players. And they didn't do him any favors. And the guys that he picked also didn't do him any favors. And if you have a team of 12 guys where 8 or 9 of them aren't playing well at all, and they're among the bottom half of the 24-man field in terms of strokes gained and performance measures, of course you're going to lose. And I don't really think there was a whole lot Zach Johnson could have done about that in terms of pairing or rah-rah speeches. If you just play poorly, then there's really nothing a captain can do.
I hate the term, it just means more. I always think that's kind of silly because it really disparages the side you're talking about on the other side. But it does feel like the Europeans love this. They really love this. Am I misreading this on the United States part? I mean, I just get the feeling when I watch Europe, they can't wait for these things. They are dying to be on these teams. And it feels like the United States, it's like, yeah, they make the Ryder Cup. They want to be on the Ryder Cup. But it does feel different on the European side. Am I misreading this?
No, I don't think so at all. I think since they have leaned so heavy on the life, the spirit, the competitive juices of Seve Ballesteros, the Europeans have long bought into this idea as carrying on his tradition. And that they're doing it for him, a borderline cult-like of we are in this for him, and we are going to then do it for each other, and then we're going to do it for the next generation. We're doing it for the past, present, and future. And they have bought into that wholeheartedly. And the one thing that I think they do extremely well in these weeks is they all check their ego at the door, and the best players on each European team go out of their way to lift up the worst players. And they're all world-class players, but Robert McIntyre is not on the level of Rory McIlroy. Nikolai Højgaard is not on the level yet of Victor Hovland. You know, those kinds of things. Justin Rose used to be one of the best guys. Now he's one of the older guys. But they all figure out how to lift each other up. And for 3 days, they are all the same. They are all the best in the world. The Americans are not like that. They have a buddy system where all that they really want is to have their best friend playing with them. And they don't really care about anybody or anything else. And that's why Sam Burns is on the team. That's why Jordan Spieth, I mean, he would have been on anyway, but that's why he plays with Justin Thomas. Xander Schauffele, that's why he plays with Patrick Cantlay. They're playing with their best friends. They're not playing as a unit. They're not playing together. And individualism or, you know, a buddy system can work well when you've got that very clear home course advantage, home country, home venue advantage. But it doesn't work very well in a venue where if your best buddy doesn't play well, you're toast, and there's nothing else you can do. There's nothing else you can rely on. You all kind of get a little fractured. And a lot of these guys on the American side, frankly, view playing the Ryder Cup as an obligation because they don't get paid to play. They get $200,000 to donate to charity. And for as much as Patrick Cantlay and some of the assistant captains wanted to deny that there was some fracturing in the team room, it was evident because Stefan Schauffele, who's Xander Schauffele's dad, came out today and talked about it and said, yeah, we want money. We wanted more stuff. We didn't like what the PGA of America is, how they're running this. So we want to take over. And that is the backdrop by which the Americans play this. Of course, you're not going to be successful when that's the case.
Do we need on the American side? And again, inspiration, but you brought it up with Seve. We don't have a Seve. Like, we don't have an icon of this. Like, I was thinking the one person they kept promoting in the broadcast was Jack Nicklaus conceding to Tony Jacklin. Like, that, is that the only thing we have? Like, we don't have a guy that's like, I'm fighting for this. I will fight you, Paul Azinger. I will fight you, anybody on the American side. Like Seve did. Paul Leisinger was talking about it. Seve was one of the first persons to call him when he had the cancer. But he fought you, and he would fight for what he was on the team. Everybody grew up idolizing Tiger Woods. Could Tiger take that spot? Could we have some inspiration? They threw out a banner for him, for crying out loud. That was incredible.
Yeah. I mean, Seve took this thing to heart because he took it so personally that the American golf world didn't respect him as much as he probably deserved. In fact, deserved. And that has bled through 40 years, 45 years of this competition, to the point where they have truly built a cult around it. They have built a culture, is what they would say, around it. And they build in every single time, even when it's clear they have home field advantage, that they're the underdog and that the Americans underestimate them and the American fans underestimate them. And we're going to show them that we're better than they think we are. And we don't have anything close to that because we assume we're the best. We assume we're the favorite. We're supposed to win. We're supposed to go over there and crush them because we have the best individual golfers. But it doesn't work that way in match play. It doesn't work that way in team competition. And there has not been a rallying cry, even though some of the guys on the team, Justin Thomas, Jordan Spieth, are among several guys. Max Homa was amazing. Brian Harman was great team spirit-wise, who really got into this thing of, I want to do this together. I want to play for my country and for this to mean something. But then you have guys like Cantlay and Schauffele who are over there just arms crossed, don't want to really be there, but they got to be there because otherwise it looks really bad. And so you almost need 12 guys to get in and say, okay, you qualified, or we're going to put you on the team. But do you really care? And if you don't, just stay home. We'll find other guys who will play spirited golf that actually give a damn.
All right. Is there any way that these entities, the Ryder Cup entity, could say, all right, look, maybe the home team is just too advantageous. They get the boost from the crowd. Maybe give the visiting team something in return. Maybe you get to set up the course, or you get to decide foursomes or best ball, whatever it is. You get to decide that. Is there something that they can do to just go, it may be a little, but it's at least a concession so that the home team isn't so advantageous in this thing?
Yeah, I have heard some interesting ideas. I've heard that, you know, course setup wise, maybe you let the home team set it up, or you have a neutral party who sets it up, who's not involved with either side, who they set up the course. That could be a piece of it. But frankly, I didn't think the Marco Simone setup was so advantageous to the Europeans that it was unfair. Frankly, I thought it was more advantageous to the Americans, except for the fact that, as the Europeans pointed out after they won, the Americans all hit cuts. So they played a golf course where a draw was favored. Well, no matter, that adds up over 18-hole matches again and again and again. But you're still, you know, that's venue selection. They do that 10, 12 years out. You have no idea what that's going to look like when you get your team there. So that they knew an advantage and exploited it, but it wasn't a setup thing. So maybe that's one thing, or maybe you have the home team set up the front nine and the back team, or the away team set up the back nine or something like that. That's something. Or maybe you have the away team gets to pick what goes first each day, or at least the first day. So instead, you know, the Europeans pick foursomes, maybe we would pick four balls. Something like that, but I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. I think this thing makes too much money for that to kind of be changed fundamentally.
Ryan, great stuff. Thanks for joining us on a trip back from Rome. Really great. Thank you so much, as always.
Thanks, Tony.
Ryan Ballingy, Golf News Net, on the Ryder Cup and another loss to the United States on European soil. We'll see you in 2 years at Bethpage in New York City. Back to the NFL when we come back. It's Wake Up Call, Sports Map Radio.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right. By the way, Major League Baseball playoffs start tomorrow.
Crazy.
You know what I like? One of the reasons I do like October is, like, we're now at that point, and then it obviously gets less and less as we have less teams, but now you're like, tomorrow, starting at like 2 o'clock Central, like, this is going to be baseball on. Overlapping each other.
Yep.
All these games.
Meaningful baseball, which is a lot different. I think that's part of the downside of baseball having 162 games. And I don't ever want to see it change. But there is that point when you get to like May, June, July, baseball is happening, which is a great feeling. But at the same time, you're like, well, if they lose, they lose. No big deal. Whatever.
Houston ended up winning the West when it was all said and done over the weekend. They tied with the Texas Rangers for 90 wins, but Texas goes to the wild card round. And so here's your quick schedule for Tuesday. And these are the wild card matchups. And the cool thing about the wild card, best 2 out of 3, all the games are in one location. So they're not flying. That's it. You just do them. You bang them out right here. Tampa Bay and Texas will be back. That's amazing to me. As good as both these teams have been, that they just weren't good enough. And one of these teams is going to be done by the end of Thursday. Right, even if not sooner.
Now, will it be the small market team or the team with one of the highest payrolls?
Right, exactly. So, Texas and Tampa, that's going to be at Tropicana Field. Toronto and Minnesota. Minnesota won the Central. Toronto, a wild card team. Arizona wild card team will take on Milwaukee. Milwaukee won the NL Central. And then Miami and Philadelphia is your other wild card team matchup in Major League Baseball. So that's going to run through this week with Atlanta and the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Baltimore Orioles.
The
and
who?
The Houston Astros waiting. Yes. So.
The Baltimore Orioles are a division winner?
I asked this at the beginning of the season, and I said, didn't the Orioles go on strong last year? Should they do? Nah. I was like, okay. I'll take people's word for it that the Orioles don't have 162-game staying power, but they were wrong. They did.
They did.
Still can't name 5 Orioles, but I guess I'll roll with that as we get
I don't know who it was. I saw this. I can't remember where I saw it either, but somebody had listed the 100-win seasons the Orioles have had.
Oh, yeah?
And so, obviously, 2023 started it. And they listed every single year in a red X next to every single year until you got to 1980.
Wow. 1980 was the last 100-plus.
So two things about this. Yeah, 1980 was the last time they had a 100-win season. And somebody literally typed out every single year and put a red X next to it all the way, like every single year.
Nice.
From,
well done.
That's dedication to do that.
That is a dedicated post.
And did it in the long way, too. Not, you know, it was like they went like 2023, green check, enter. Right. 2022, red X. 2021, red X.
We have two. Well, I don't want to be melancholy to close out this hour.
No.
There are two sad stories to report. Tim Wakefield passed away over the weekend.
Yes, he did.
Knuckleball pitcher for the Red Sox. He was brought into the league by the Pirates. Went to the Red Sox. Tim Wakefield had we talk about some athletes in a year turnaround, right? What could happen to you in one calendar year? And Tim Wakefield went from he gave up the Aaron Boone home run in 03. He was the guy that, I mean, it was a walk-off series clinching, all done, be gone, Boston home run.
Well, that's where Aaron got his nickname.
That's right. And then the next year, he was part of that team that went on to beat the Yankees down 3-1, 3-0, and won the World Series, beating St. Louis. And then he helped them win the 2007 World Series against the Cardinals. Knuckleballer. If you love knuckleball pitchers, Tim Wakefield was one of the best.
And he had, I mean, I love watching videos. Slow-mo.
Oh, yeah.
The slow-mo video of a knuckleball pitcher and like some of the ones he threw. God bless the catchers.
That's right. I know. No kidding.
I mean, forget no you. Kidding. We all know batters can't hit it. And if they do get it, it's either just going to be a pop-up or a ground ball because they're slapping at the ball. But, my God, these catchers, I mean, they must be bruised to you-know-what by the end of the game.
Yeah, I know.
Just
I know. Wakefield had brain cancer. It wasn't public. I think Kurt Schilling.
He
was the one that leaked that.
Which was a weird, weird angle to that story.
Yeah. He was on a podcast, right? Or was it his podcast?
I think it was his podcast and decided to share it, even though no one in the family wanted it to be shared.
The organization was quiet on it.
Yeah.
Like the organization knew, and Schilling just brings it up in a podcast. By the way, who's monitoring podcasts all the time for everything everyone is saying constantly?
I don't know.
Knows how quickly that goes into?
Thinking there's a job for that.
They're somewhere. They're monitoring everything people say. The other sad bit of news, if you're from a certain age group, I guess, was that a former Pro Bowl tight end, Russ Francis, was killed in a plane crash Sunday in Lake Placid, New York. So that was sad. He was a New England Patriot when I was growing up in New England. He was part of the Steve Grogan, John Hanna, Stanley Morgan, you know, Patriots of the 70s and early 80s. But he won a Super Bowl with the 49ers when he moved played on with the 49ers in 1982 and won Super Bowl that year, Super Bowl 19 against the Miami Dolphins. So Russ Francis passed away as well. So didn't mean to end on a melancholy note, but I wanted to bring at least bring up those two notable passings from the weekend. So NFL Monday Night Football tonight, the Giants are the, and the Seahawks. Manningcast is back tonight.
Manningcast is back tonight.
It should be. Now we're done with this doubleheader nonsense.
Well, we're not done with it.
With. When is it coming back?
I think week 14.
Yeah, goodness. All right, whatever. That'll be fine.
Yeah, week 14, I think we're, you know, we'll be removed from it. They'll be like, yeah, you know.
That's good. I'll be fine.
Well, I'll be fine with that then.
Yeah, that'll work. But, you know, hey, Sunday morning with the Atlanta Falcons and Jacksonville Jaguars in the last the game. So it opened up with that, and then it closed with the Jets almost pulling it off against Kansas City. By the way, Patrick Mahomes sliding out of bounds like they did in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Cost millions.
Millions. Was he on the fix?
It was Mecole Hardman that was the one that didn't go in the end zone, I think.
Right.
During the Super Bowl with the Eagles. And Patrick Mahomes doing the exact same thing, shifted millions.
I know there's a lot of people who are like, why didn't you just score a touchdown? You know, I needed the fantasy points. I mean, it's like, it's a smart move.
It's a smart move.
Game is over. Jets had no more timeouts. I mean, I think there was even a possible delay of game, or not delay of game, but I think the NFL just went ahead like it was. I don't know. It's a delay of game. When the clock runs out, it's a delay of game.
That's right. That's right.
I think there was a possible delay of game, but they were just like, no, it doesn't matter.
No, we're done. Yeah, this game's over. Oh, I agree with you. I think people who snap at players for their fantasy points or money are ridiculous.
Right.
I mean, it's just the way the game's going. You know what? I don't know. Bet better. I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to. Like, if you have Patrick Mahomes, I have a tendency to think you're doing okay. Like, you know,
right.
You may not win every week, but if you were able to get Patrick Mahomes on your fantasy team, yeah, you're going to be fine in the long run when it's all said and done. I think you're doing pretty good. Exactly. So, but I thought I was glad last night's game was better than it should have been.
I was so scared. Because I mean, you and I were talking before the show. It was 17-0, I think, in 6.6 seconds.
Oh, God.
You know, it was like a car. It just went vroom. And it was like, before you could even turn it on, it was like, hey, look, I guess the Jets are saying we're spotting you 17 points. Like, is that how it works?
Yeah, right.
And then the Jets settled down. That second quarter was phenomenal.
That's right. And I thought it was good. Zach Wilson is earning a lot of praise, and he should be. He took the blame when – it's not his fault, and they told him it wasn't his fault. It's really, you know, we just talked about how you can go in 1 year, and Zach Wilson went from a New York problem when he was, you know, denying everything and just being, you know, the
and
lone
literally
guy.
having King Jet say just trade him.
That's right.
Yeah, who cares what you get for him? Just get him off your team.
So now people are flipping it onto the side of going, you know what? That was pretty good. We didn't win, but that was a good performance.
And that's why I brought it up too. I could not stand Rodney Harrison just even post game. I understand pregame. I get it. That's the narrative that we all went in thinking that. And for the first quarter, it looked like that. But then post game, like, you got to give him credit where credit's due. Chris Jones is still, you know, rifling at him, or you're trying to get Chris Jones to say something. And I'm glad Chris Jones didn't take the bait.
Yeah. Yeah, and listen, I think all of us doing that, I know we did. I mean, it wasn't looking good at all, I mean, he was playing terrible. And but again, it's difficult to go people were saying, well, they have to go get somebody. And we were saying, got to go get somebody. But there really wasn't a lot of great options. Like, it wasn't like it was just a bunch of people. But
no, and for all you people who said, go get Kirk Cousins.
Yeah, right. Right. I know. Exactly.
Rethinking that one, maybe, right?
But, trade for Baker Mayfield or like whatever what people were coming up with. It's not as easy as it sounds. There wasn't a lot of money for the Jets to go after and get anybody. And at least for this week, people can just calm that down a little bit. No, again, maybe next week you're like, wow, okay, that was fun while it lasted as he throws three picks and two of them return for touchdowns. I get it. But at least for one game, he withstood that energy, that negative energy, and played really well.
A primetime game, too.
And a primetime game as well, where everybody was watching. Yeah. All right, we'll continue with his wake-up call again on Twitter, @TonyDRadio, @RonCulver. That's Ron with two N's on a good Monday to you.